This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Measures for Justice is a data-driven nonprofit tracking county-by-county data for crime, arrests, prosecutions, and more in an effort to assess and hold accountable the criminal justice system and attempts at reform. Supported by prosecutors and legal experts, including former Florida Attorney General Richard Duran, the Sunshine State is just one of six states for which the project has collected county-by-county data for some of its planned 32 metrics. Those metrics include things like the average length of stay for a misdemeanor, which in Florida could range from as brief as 12 days behind bars to as many as 180 days in other counties. Another metric they track is the average cost of court fees, which in Washington state varied from $600 in one county to as much as $2,300 in another. Here to talk with us about this data-driven approach to understanding our criminal justice system and the ways this data could be used to influence everything from existing policies to future reforms are three guests from across Florida and the country. First, joining us from New York State is Measures for Justice Director of Research, Dr. Gypsy Escobar. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you so much.
From Florida, we're joined by Walton County Sheriff Michael Adkinson. He's been involved with this data-driven approach in his Panhandle community. I want to thank you for joining the show, too.
Thank you for having us.
Also joining us today from Tallahassee is Deborah Brodsky. She's a legal expert with Florida's Project on Accountable Justice. Welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for having us.
We're talking about the ways data can reveal whether our criminal justice system is working or not. Do you think it's working? And what numbers do you want to know about Florida's arrests, courts, and jails? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag of GCL. So first, Dr. Gypsy Escobar with Measures for Justice, how did this project even get started?
This project has been 6 years in the making. It started when the executive founder of Measures for Justice, Amy Back, wrote a book called Ordinary Injustice, where basically she traveled the country and found stories where justice might not be going right. Her conclusion was that these things were ordinary. These things were happening everywhere, but we didn't know because we didn't have data. So she put together a group of people 6 years ago to start developing the idea of collecting the data, what will be the right metrics. We started with 50 aspirational measures, but then we piloted with real data and discovered that the data for the ideal measures was not there. So we started working from whatever data was available and came to these 32 performance metrics, which will continue growing, that are now populated with court data.
So what are the ultimate goals of compiling data like this?
Well, the general goal is to bring transparency to the criminal justice system. We tend to know a lot about of what's happening in criminal justice in the larger jurisdictions. We talk about Chicago, we talk about New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, but we know very little of what's going on in medium-sized and smaller jurisdictions unless something, makes it to the news, something bad makes it to the news. So the idea here is to allow the public, but also the agents of the criminal justice system, to understand the patterns that may be happening in their jurisdictions, because sometimes even the prosecutors, the sheriffs, they may not be knowing what's going on because they don't have the resources to process the data they do collect on a daily basis. So the idea here is to provide that tool to basically start asking questions of what may be going on in a jurisdiction.
So nobody ever put anything like this together before? Nobody ever, had a tracking database for what's happening with criminal justice, recidivism, things like that?
Not at this scale. The Bureau of Justice Statistics at the federal level, they still gather data on the 75 largest counties in terms of how felonies are processed by state courts. But aside from that and other very discrete efforts, there was no one single place that was measuring the system from beginning to end and with the idea of measuring every single jurisdiction in the country.
All right. So I just wanted to mention to our listeners, if you're just joining us, we just had an emergency alert went out. But if you're wondering what our show's about, let me give you a quick recap. We're talking about Measures for Justice, which is a data-driven nonprofit tracking county-by-county data for crime, arrests, prosecutions, and more in an effort to assess and hold accountable the criminal justice system and attempts at reform. And we're talking with Dr. Gypsy Escobar, who's in New York, and she's one of the researchers with Measures for Justice. We're also talking with Walton County Sheriff Michael Adkinson up in the Panhandle, and we're talking with Deborah Brodsky, who is a legal expert in Florida in Tallahassee. So just a quick recap in case you're just joining us and missed some of that from the beginning of the show because of the emergency alert. So getting back into it, I wanted to ask Dr. Escobar, what would you consider an example of the criminal justice system failing?
What we recommend people do with the measures is to look at them in together. So a single measure is not going to tell you everything about the criminal justice system. It's all of them in conjunction that can tell you about the health of the system. And things have to be looked at, you know, from the perspective of different offense types and the characteristics of the defendants as well. But perhaps a measure that will be interesting is that a lot of guilty pleas are, for both felonies and misdemeanors, are taking place without attorney. That might be, in some counties, the rate is very high. So that might indicate that there is something going on with the, particularly the indigent defense system in that jurisdiction that needs to be addressed. But we should definitely not be having very high rates of guilty pleas without attorney in felony cases, for instance.
Okay, and maybe something like recidivism, would that be an indicator of where a certain criminal justice system in a certain area is not working ideally?
That's a little bit more complicated. Recidivism is kind of a, in criminology, is a bit of a controversial concept. It's measured in different ways. So we do have two measures of recidivism. One is the reconviction rate for people released on probation, and the other one is the reconviction rate for people released from prison. But the recidivism rate may say something about the criminal justice system, particularly in terms of whether the goals of sentencing were met, but it also says a lot about the community itself. So it is not just a reflection of the system itself. It's also a reflection of the community.
Yeah, and also the numerous individuals that we're talking about, too.
Right.
And then, would a success maybe be considered fewer people behind bars for misdemeanor offenses? Is that what would be considered a point where the justice system is doing well?
Yeah, that's something that people from both sides of the aisle have been discussing for the last decade or so. And it's a way of dealing with mass incarceration, which we know now hasn't had the expected effects. So a lot of people are talking about having alternatives to incarceration for minor offenses. So, you know, having a smaller rate of nonviolent misdemeanors that are sentenced to jail, and making sure that those that do make it to jail are there for shorter sentences should definitely help with mass incarceration. So a lot of the measures are getting at kind of like standards that people have been discussing for the last couple of decades in terms of still protecting public safety and having a fair process while, you know, reducing the number of people we have in jail and prison.
Mm-hmm. And your data is in six states only. Why is that?
Because it's a huge endeavor.
It's a big country, right?
Yeah, it's a really, very big country.
Is the goal to get all of them?
Yeah, the goal is to, well, the immediate goal is to get 20 states by 2020. There are some states where there are no case management systems, where things have not been computerized. So we started with these six original states for two reasons. One, we knew that the state, the administrative office of the courts, had centralized data sets for the courts, you know, all the state courts across the state. So we wouldn't have to go county by county. And two, they were representative of different regions of the country. So that's why the first six states. It's a very slow process. People talk about the criminal justice system, but in reality, we have more than 3,000 criminal justice systems in America. So
yeah, it doesn't operate
so
as a whole, and it doesn't operate.
operate right. the same in every county either.
Exactly.
And they're probably going to have different data collection in different counties based on what their funding levels are and things like that. One of the states that was included is, of course, Florida, which is where we are. And Deborah Brodsky works with a criminal justice reform think tank called Florida's Project on Accountable Justice. So, Deborah, what did you see in the data that was released for Florida's counties?
I think what it does, and first of all, I just want to say that PAJ, Project on Accountable Justice, we are dedicated to advancing public safety through research and evidence. What we found when we launched in 2012 was a huge hole in sort of available resources for the public and for criminal justice stakeholders to actually leverage and really start to reimagine a system that was fairer, more cost-effective, and met sort of the public standards of what we expect from our public safety. And so the measures came along, and Project on Accountable Justice really treasures these measures because they bring this new level of transparency, accountability, and direct engagement with the public in a one-stop shopping place for us to really begin these conversations. What we saw and what we knew anecdotally in sort of the differences across the counties is appearing in the measures as well, across all the measures, across the state, and in comparison to other states and other counties, we see a disparity all over the place and differences. Some of it is a reflection of community standards, and some of it is really a reflection of not really knowing what's been occurring at the local level. So this, to us, is groundbreaking, first really important step toward the kinds of discussions that we can hold at the state level by gathering criminal justice stakeholders and the public together to review, examine, and reimagine criminal justice systems that work for us in our interest.
So I want to put a question before you that's a bit challenging, but can you make a case for me why someone who's not involved in the criminal justice system, they don't work in it, they're not being prosecuted for a crime, how do you get someone that's completely apart from it to care about it and to care about taking a look at these kinds of numbers?
Sure. Well, here's a real-time context to put this in. Right now, Florida legislature is somewhere in the Capitol deliberating the next version of Florida state budget. $2.4 billion goes to our Department of Corrections. That's a lot of money, and in comparison sort of in what is the discretionary part of our revenue that we're able to spend on things like education and healthcare and all the things that matter to people in their communities, that $2.4 billion is $2.4 billion unavailable to Florida for other resources. So if you don't care about criminal justice, which I find very difficult, I think most people feel very strongly about being safe in their own communities, particularly for their families.
Well, I think there are some people who might look at it like, well, it's not my problem. The somebody committed a crime, they're in jail, forget it, it's a done deal, and they don't really think about it past that. So what you're saying is the importance is that it is making a dollars and cents equation for some people as far as where their tax money is being spent and whether they're getting results for that kind of an investment.
Absolutely. This is an exercise in understanding where our hard-earned taxpayer resources are going to, and are we getting what we want? This is a way, a benchmarking exercise. This portal now provides an entree for the community to come in and say, hey, how are we doing? Are we getting what we want from this? And just to carry that analogy a little bit more, the example that I use is in the measures themselves, in what percentage of a community's nonviolent felonies get sentenced to prison, and in some communities it's quite a few, and in others it's very low. What does that mean? That means that at the end of that, if we're sending folks to our state prison system, all of us as taxpayers are paying for that, but we don't get to decide that in the communities. The community level is where those decisions are made. We need to have a better understanding of that to really understand the overall impact of these decisions made at the local level.
And Walton County Sheriff Michael Atkinson, what do you think of having this kind of information distilled and available for everyone to take a look at?
Well, I think it's critically important for us to be able to make evidence-based policies and procedures that you know, as I quite often say, I can make an moral argument why it's incorrect to do some of these things, but I can also make a fiscal argument. So by allowing to by allowing the public to be able to see it, it also allows us to determine the efficacy, quite honestly, of the court and judicial system. Are we functioning at a level that is both cost-effective and appropriate? And really, this is the first attempt, and why I truly applaud this effort. It's the first attempt to really put a grade on it. And, you know, in a lot of ways, we all seek data that confirms our own bias, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is the data itself is agnostic. And so I just think that this allows the average citizen to say, how well is your criminal justice system working locally? And is it being efficient? Is it being fair and just? So, you know, I think it really touches, you know, people from as diverse as maybe a political ideology is extremely liberal or extremely conservative. I think everybody has an interest in this at some level.
Well, everybody definitely has a stake in it. So you're out there on the front lines and you're dealing with criminals making arrests. Does the criminal justice system start with your department, or is it mostly in the hands of the court system?
So, you know, obviously the initial point of intake is normally your law enforcement agency. I mean, that's where this is at. But to put a – maybe this will help perspective-wise for some of your listeners. In a state like Florida where – and I'm going to use a round number, but just say roughly 3 million-plus driver's licenses are suspended on any given day. You know, of those, about 1 million-plus have absolutely nothing to do with driving.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, any law enforcement officer in the state could make a decision – to take every one of those 1 million people to jail under Florida law. I mean, you could conceptually do that. Is that the best use of our resources? And I would argue it's not.
It's interesting, though, the role that each part plays going into this.
Certainly.
Have you seen things working based on this data in your community so far?
Yeah, so we've actually, you know, had the opportunity to work with Dr. Escobar and the folks up there and through Project Accountable Justice that, you know, it's given us an opportunity to kind of look. If you know, one of the things, one of the measures we look at here in Walton County, for instance, is the ability to divert people, misdemeanor diversion, about how long they actually go to jail or whether or not we're able to divert them prior to sending them to jail. And I think that helps us very real-time make decisions about what is best public policy. For instance, I'll be very specific with this. If I made the decision as the chief law enforcement officer in the county that said every misdemeanor arrest goes to jail every time, you know, initially regardless, you know, my jail would be overcrowded almost immediately. However, by making assessments based on actual risk, not on what I can do, but what should be done and what is good public safety judgment, you know, we're able to hold that cost down. And if you figure it costs roughly $60 a day to house an inmate, you know, that's a conservative average in many places in Florida. That is a very real-time cost savings. And it also doesn't affect the, you know, it also doesn't take into account the soft effect of if I arrest somebody for driving while I suspend or revoke and I take them to jail and they sit in jail for 2 or 3 days because they can't raise the bond fee. What if they lose their job? What about the children that don't go to school the next morning? And the reality is they don't pose a public safety risk. So we're not talking about public safety. I mean, I want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
We're talking about, well, even, you know, there's some misdemeanors that may be violent, but we're talking about good public safety policy.
We have to take a quick break right now before we continue our conversation about measuring data on our country's criminal justice system. Now is a great time, though, to send in your questions or comments. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. We're taking a break because WGCU is in the midst of its 3-day June radio pledge drive. It's called Nourish Your Mind, Nourish Your Body. You can take part, and here's how. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for staying with us. We are talking about hard data and the story it tells about successes and failures in criminal justice reform. A nonprofit has been working since 2011 for the first time to take a look at the numbers in our justice system to see where it's failing and where it's doing well. We're talking with one of the authors of that study, Dr. Gypsy Escobar, a Florida criminal justice reform think tank representative, Deborah Brodsky, and also Walton County Sheriff Michael Atkinson. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 877-428-8255. 8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Gypsy Escobar, Measures for Justice looks at three things when they're quantifying the data. One is fiscal responsibility, and then fair process, and then public safety. How is fiscal responsibility assessed?
Fiscal responsibility is basically assessed by the standards I was mentioning before. There is a number of things that we know are very costly to taxpayers that reformers on both sides of the aisle want to change. So, for instance, the sending, as Sheriff Atkinson was mentioning earlier, sending minor offenders, nonviolent minor offenders to jail pre-trial and after conviction might not be the best way of using resources. So when you go to the portal and you can click fiscal responsibilities moved up to the measures that relate to fiscal responsibility move up to the top, you'll see things like, for instance, for nonviolent misdemeanors, whether the police is giving the suspect a citation to appear in court instead of arresting them and booking them in jail. That's considered a resource-saving approach that was actually encouraged by the 21st Century Policing Task Force. Early screening by prosecutors' offices is also another way of saving resources. So whenever they receive a case that is not very weak, that is very weak and is unlikely to get a conviction in court, prosecutors may decline to prosecute that case, saving resources to the system and also saving all the collateral consequences to the suspect. Sheriff Atkinson was mentioning before, if they go to jail, they lose their job, they may have problems with custody, et cetera.
How is fairness quantified? Is that by comparing county to county to see if people are treated the same in different places, or how do you assess that?
Right. So with fair process, what we're looking at is the degree to which the system preserves individual liberties by affording people due process. So it's basically the measures revolve around the concept of due process and also by the idea of delivering legal services equally across demographics. So people can filter any of the measures by, for instance, things like race or indigent status, sex, age, to make sure, they can see whether there are any disparities across any of these demographics. And what you often do see is racial disparities.
And then how is public safety accounted for?
Public safety is looking at the degree to which the system works to keep people safe from crime. That one of the measures that looks at public safety is that recidivism measures that we were discussing before. Mm-hmm. We are currently working to develop law enforcement measures that we have not yet. So we're going to put a council of experts together for this. And I think a lot of those measures are going to actually get to the idea of public safety as well.
And then Deborah Brodsky with Florida's Project on Accountable Justice. Here in our state, we've had the civil citation option since 2011, and that's where police have the option to give a juvenile first offender a civil citation rather than arrest them and get them into the juvenile justice system. Have you seen data results from the implementation of that? Has it been a success so far?
Yes, it's been a wonderful state and national success. Florida's really a leader in employing this strategy that basically recognizes that kids do lots of dumb things and sometimes get caught up in the criminal justice system unnecessarily as a result of it. And what we've learned through robust data collection at the local and the state level, just on this one measure, is that we are able to actually increase our public safety, that is, reduce recidivism by processing kids through the citation process, which really is a sanction that does not give them an arrest, which does not unduly hamper them with the sort of collateral consequences of having an arrest that follow them through life, and in fact ensures that they actually take care of business, do community service, and that's really a success that has grown as a result of what I call sort of this organic, community-driven, stakeholder-led initiative that data has shown comparatively across the state in places where it's not working, the public and community stakeholders together recognize that, hey, our neighbors next door are doing better on this measure than we are. Perhaps we should look to improve our own and offer these, you know, this has been a remarkable success story in actually reducing recidivism, improving safety, and cutting costs. This is what we envision for the measures on the adult side of the criminal justice system, which has not had such a tool available for Floridians yet. And so this is what's really exciting about it. You're going to see people learning from these measures, building it into their own portfolio of reengineering and really making stronger, more accountable, and certainly more responsive local criminal justice systems as a result of it.
Yeah, and then Sheriff Atkinson, I want to compare a data point that might help people kind of understand a little bit more about how this kind of data understanding can have an impact on how police departments and sheriff's departments work, and then how it also then impacts public safety. If I'm looking at the rate of arrest for violent crime in Southwest Florida, down here we see a rate of about 115 to 150 people per 100,000. But then in your county, we see that rate go up to more than 230,000 arrests per 100,000. Do we draw from this difference that you have your officers, when they're not bothering as much with more of the small-time criminals, being able to pay more attention to violent crime?
Well, I think it's a couple of things, you know, and certainly I don't want to overgeneralize the data in and of itself, but to say, yes, that what that should emphasize is they focused on those things that require more law enforcement or police attention. And that's ultimately, you know, that's good public policy. It's good for the communities that we live in to use the resources wisely toward, you know, the more appropriate public safety risk.
And another measure that shows differences in Florida is when they track the median jail time for misdemeanor offenses is 25 days on average for your county up there in Walton County in the Panhandle. But not far from you is Jackson County, where the average jail time is 180 days. Down here in Southwest Florida, we average around 60. As a law enforcement officer, what does that data mean to you? What does it show you?
Let me just give you a real quick analogy or example, if you will, that I think can help illustrate this for your listeners. So I know of a local jail that it has something in the neighborhood of about 90 to 100 misdemeanors in jail because they cannot raise $100 for bond money. Now, if I know that that particular county is spending $70 a day to house them, does that make good fiscal sense to spend, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars because they can't raise $100 on a nonviolent felony? So, yes, that is significant. What it will tell you looking at these counties comparatively in a county like Walton County, where we make decisions, again, based on who should be going to jail based on the level of risk that we believe are assessed.
Is there a risk, though, if you're not going to arrest the misdemeanor offender, that they won't show up when it comes time for them to look at a judge?
Well, so certainly nothing is absolute, correct? I mean, the reality of it is that we have to be prepared to face criticism when we don't make these types of arrests. And you know, unfortunately, that comes with the business I'm in. You have to make good judgment decisions based on sound public policy, but not based on political ideologies, if that makes any sense. I mean, we just have to accept in the law enforcement community that you know, that this is the kind of thing we should be doing and accept that. And one of the great things I always tell people is that, you know, if your child receives a break, for instance, you know, a civil citation, then that's an appropriate use of justice in your opinion. If somebody else's child does and you don't get that, then you think it's draconian. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, that becomes a matter of where you are sitting. Everybody wants accountability till it applies to them. But public safety professionals, the criminal justice system should not get into that. We should make data-driven, evidence-based decisions based on the knowledge that we have. And that's where things like Measures for Justice are so critical. I mean, that's why we applaud this effort, is because it allows us to make decisions so that I can stand up and justify the actions that I'm taking.
Yeah, having data to back you up does help when you're making any kind of an argument. And things, when you have actual hard numbers that are showing, well, this worked here, and this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. It makes it easier to forge that path.
Well, you know, certainly theoretically that's true. Now, you can't let the facts get in the way of a good story if you are simply trying to justify a position. But for most reasonable people, this is the way business should be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, any business is looked at with the data, with your return on your investment. Every business is looked at in that way. But this is one that just hasn't up to this point until now. So Dr. Escobar, one of the things that he mentioned, that the sheriff mentioned, was people unable to make bond. And that kind of highlights the indigent population, I suppose, or people that are, just don't have as much money. And you mentioned earlier a statistic that tells us a lot about how courts handle cases, and it's the data on guilty pleas on misdemeanor cases without an attorney. And I don't get arrested a lot, but I've watched a lot of crime shows, and you always have the "you have a right to an attorney." Do people that have committed a misdemeanor not have a right to an attorney?
Right. That's interesting because I think because of those crime shows, people misunderstand the right to an attorney. That what the constitutional law says is that you have the right to an attorney in a criminal case if you are if what they call life and liberty are at stake. So basically, if you're facing capital punishment or you're facing jail or prison time. So if you are facing a misdemeanor that where the most serious sentence that you could get is a fine or community service, you do not have the right to an appointed counsel. So what's happening in some jurisdictions is that, you know, upward to almost 80% of misdemeanors who enter a guilty plea did so without an attorney. And there is this misconception that misdemeanor, having a conviction for a misdemeanor, is not such a bad thing, right? But it does end up having collateral consequences, especially when they start accumulating, and they may have consequences, you know, down the line for future, you know, sentencing and things like that. So that's one, like, you know, that Sheriff Atkinson was very accurately saying, like, the whole point of the measures for justice is that for people to sit down, look at it, look at the patterns, and discuss what's happening and what could be behind this. So, you know, this guilty pleas without attorney are definitely something that merit some discussion by policymakers.
And we were talking a little bit with the sheriff, Dr. Escobar, about the difficulty in selling people on the way that you want to do things. It's but having the data to back you up, have you noticed that people are able to use this data to enact some, you know, reforms on the local level that make a difference?
Absolutely, absolutely. Even though we've only been public for 3 weeks now, because we made the data, the preliminary data, accessible to people like Sheriff Walton, who served as external reviewers to make sure that, you know, what we were showing was accurate. We had several practitioners, particularly prosecutors, that have actually already started taking action based on things that they saw on the data. So one example is a prosecutor in Florida, a state attorney in Florida, who oversees, I believe, his district oversees, I believe, five counties. And he was able to look at the cases not prosecuted rate combined with the cases dismissed rate for his five counties. And he saw that all counties had very different rates under the same circuit. So this to him was not an eye-opening, but it was a confirmation of a hunch that he had. He said something like, I knew this was happening, but now I have the data to go and talk to my prosecutors and show it to them and say, okay, so how come you're not declining any cases and you're declining so many, and, you know, and so on.
So, and then coming back to Florida, Deborah Brodsky with Florida's Project on Accountable Justice, we were talking a little bit about misdemeanors. What happens to somebody in Florida when they have a lot of misdemeanors that just keep piling up? Does that ever become or turn into a felony down here?
Well, the point system, so our sentencing will result in a higher level of sanctions. So what we don't want to see are people going in and out, and Sheriff Atkinson knows this better than anyone. A lot of low-level folks going in for the kinds of things that, you know, poverty often makes criminal involvement more likely. Those kinds of things that we could address at the community level that end up at the state prison system just don't make sense anymore. So this is a way to really kind of have that conversation, look at a much more localized and specific level at measures that we didn't have before, so that we are able to really trace back those drivers into mass incarceration that we're talking about at the national level, too.
And another data point worth exploring is the reconviction rate in Florida. People who had a new conviction within 3 years of a previous one. Combating this has been a big hurdle for Florida and for other states. Sheriff Atkinson in Walton County, you're seeing a reconviction rate of about 15%, but in some counties in Florida, that rate's about 50%, meaning one out of every two people convicted goes on to offend again within 3 years. So what, Sheriff Atkinson, is Walton County doing differently, or what are they doing right to keep this rate so low?
Well, I think one of the things you have to realize is when you're able to divert out of the system or limit the impact or how long someone is in jail, there's some pretty good data. I'm sure Dr. Escobar or Ms. Brodsky could speak to this. The longer someone stays in the jail, the greater opportunity of having a recontact with the criminal justice system. So one of the things that we try and do is we try and take those misdemeanors that are appropriate, again, to get them out as quickly as possible. And our philosophy on that is that helps the secondary, the arrest for violation of probation, things of that nature. You know, and we understand that so many of these, as Deb had spoken about a minute ago, come back to financial obligations. You know, I have a trustee in the jail now currently that is, you know, about 38, 39 years old. He is a convicted felon, and he has never been arrested for anything other than driver's license violations. And the important thing to know about that is this: he's never had a driver's license because he lost it when he was 16 years old. The state of Florida issued him one and then immediately suspended it. And so, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars later, this guy continues to get arrested. And by the way, he's a pretty decent fellow that is going to have to continue to drive to go to work. And he said that to me.
So he keeps getting arrested because he doesn't have a valid driver's license, and then he has become now a felon.
That's correct. That's correct.
And we all know that comes with another host of issues. When you're a convicted felon, you don't get to vote, other things like that. So the misdemeanors can pile up.
Yeah, and the conversation, you know, he and I have had before, this particular trustee, and he said, you know, Sheriff, you realize when I get out, I'm going to have to drive again. I've got to work to support my family. Mm-hmm. And that's a very telling thing. And the reality of it is this particular individual, the last four or five times he's been arrested, had nothing even to do with his driving. It was simply because he was known not to have a driver's license. In other words, a deputy sheriff ran his tag for whatever reason, or there was some interaction where he was driving, but it wasn't actually the conduct of his driving itself. It was the fact that he's a felon based on his driving record. And the deputy then, with a felony, has no choice. And that's a real, real shame.
That's going to make it tough for him going forward. I don't want to get too far into his personal case, but I'm interested to follow through on that for some reason. And then back to Deborah Brodsky with Florida's Project on Accountable Justice. Are there any counties where we're seeing cost-effective alternatives to incarceration, like things like drug courts or things where instead of, you know, giving a notice to appear instead of arresting someone for not showing up?
Well, obviously, our good Sheriff Atkinson, Walton County's had success in diverting folks. Lots of wonderful experiments going on at the local level that will result in better public safety returns all over the state. Pockets of innovation, drug courts and mental health courts. You know, our jails have become the largest mental health facilities in our state and nation. That's not what they're intended to do. So all of this is going to help us really sit down, understand, and recognize the successes, celebrate the successes, and share the successes in a way that we haven't been able to so far.
And find ways to depopulate jails with
Absolutely.
Nonviolent. So, Dr. Escobar, there are a lot of efforts to change the way law enforcement officials make arrests and how the courts process those suspects and how our jails incarcerate them. Are those types of suggestions part of the research that you do? Does it list, for example, on your website, if you're looking to reduce the number of nonviolent offenders, here are different measures you can take? Like, do they give practical advice to counties and districts?
Not necessarily. Like the whole goal of the Measures for Justice portal was to provide data to policymakers and to the public, so they could go in and investigate further. Like, so one thing that the portal doesn't do is assess causality. So we tell you that, you know, A and B and C are happening, but we're not telling you that X and Y are causing them. We're not telling you what's the reason why something is happening. So the whole point of the system is to encourage conversations among local stakeholders that could help them figure out what's behind that pattern and and then, you know, maybe look at their neighbors or somebody, you know, further down south in the state or whatever that may have been having better results. And perhaps what one thing we that's kind of in the works, this is like right now at the fetal stage, but is creating these networks of practitioners so that people can help each other. So we're not really prescribing reform. We're not prescribing change. What we do is provide the data so that people can, you know, investigate more what's happening at the local level and come up with their own, like, you know, tailor-made solutions for their own jurisdictions.
Yeah, everybody on a local level has their own set of data to look at. Were you surprised at how different some of the different counties were from one another?
Yeah, absolutely. It was we didn't think we were going to see so much variation across a lot of the measures. Some measures are in some states are relatively flat, if you will, but the majority is really a slope, right? Like you have someone in the very high end, someone in the very low end, and a lot of people in the middle. So yes, it was kind of surprising to see the wide variability across jurisdictions.
And so far, the response has been pretty positive. People are pretty interested in looking at this and trying to extrapolate things and make a difference with it, you're saying?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, we've had very good response. We actually think, and this was also surprising to us, but we think the prosecutors are going to be the early adopters of using this data for policymaking because they have been the most enthusiastic about the release.
All right. Well, I want to thank our guests. We're going to have to leave it there. Our guests are Dr. Gypsy Escobar with Measures for Justice. Thanks so much for joining us today. It was really interesting kind of going over this data and learning what you've compiled, and it was a lot of work. And more work ahead.
Thank you for having me.
I also thank you to Deborah Brodsky with the Project on Accountable Justice in Florida. Thank you for taking the time to spend with us on the phone.
Thank you.
And thank you so much also to Sheriff Michael Atkinson with the Walton County Sheriff's Office. It was great having a boots-on-the-ground approach and learning kind of how this data, you know, really makes a difference. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.